Hello, this is Mark Iverson, the historian and host behind the American History Unabridged podcast. I find all history of interest, but what I find particularly intriguing are those narratives in America's past that clash. There's the status quo that we're taught in school, which is memory, really. That which we wish was true. And though some of it is true, it's been abridged. There are histories and narratives that have been omitted. Oftentimes, those are minority histories, the histories of communities that defy or challenge this idea of American exceptionalism. And they in themselves, their histories are exceptional, but have not been included in the broader narrative. These are the histories that I'd like to focus on the American History Unabridged podcast, straight out of Boise, Idaho. Thanks for listening. Thank you to the Trendy Dads out of San Francisco, California, for that wonderful cover of the B-52's Private Idaho. Before we get started tonight, I'd like to thank our sponsors, Funky Soul Coffee. That's soul with an S-O-L. It's the brainchild of Michelle Russell and Gavin Butler. These two had a dream, and that was to turn a 1976 Airstream camper into a coffee shop, a 70s-themed coffee shop. And they've succeeded. Michelle Russell has years and years of experience in the coffee industry, and she's come up with some truly delicious 70s-themed concoctions. I've had the privilege of tasting a few of them. But, you know, they create coffee for dreamers, and they create delicious coffee for dreamers. So they just open for business. You can book them for private events and see them at events throughout the Boise Valley. You can reach them at 208-447-9044. You can email them at hello@funkysoul.com. And you can find them on Instagram or at www.funkysoulcoffee.com. Give them a try. I'd like to thank you one more time for tuning in. I really appreciate you listening. Before we get started, I'd like to dedicate this episode to my father, Gary Iverson. He died last week at the age of 78. He had been a teacher in the Seattle area, taught social studies, which is, you know, geography, language arts, history, and et cetera. But he taught that to junior hires for 35 plus years. And he really is the origin point of my interest in history. His whole office downstairs in our basement was history books. He had books of great works of fiction, but he primarily had history books from, you know, exploration, European exploration of the world on the oceans, to the displacements of tribes in the Americas early on, you know, the colonial period, and then into the revolutionary period and on to the War of 1812, the antebellum South, Manifest Destiny, the Texans and the war with Mexico, and then the American war with Mexico, where we basically invaded and took over the North and were annexed the North in the 1840s, and then into the Civil War. He had major, just tons of books on the Civil War and then the quote-unquote Indian Wars. I remember going to battlefields with him from, you know, the Greasy Grass or Custer's Last Stand, a.k.a. The Little Bighorn Battle, to Fredericksburg back east of the Civil War, and Yorktown, you know, of the Revolution, where we won or turned the tide of the Revolution. You know, we went to see it. And we also went to movies. I remember Malcolm X being hugely impactful on me. We saw Glory, and I remember that movie about the 54th Massachusetts, the all-black regiment of previously mostly enslaved individuals who now had a chance to give it to the South, despite the fact that they would be summarily executed and not captured. They fought against the South and helped turn the tide of the war, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them. And so, you know, my father just basically fueled this fire in me, this curiosity, and I'm putting it to use now. And he was proud of my business, Eye to History, and of the podcast and the books that I published and wrote. And so this one's for you, Dad. I love you, and thanks. But moving on, I'd like to talk about an impactful program in United States history, one that not many people know about, and it is called the Bracero Program. And there were a couple of them. One was during World War One and a little bit after, and that was much smaller. And it ended somewhere like in 1920-21. But then the major one was during World War II and then after, from 1942 to 1964. And these were Mexican nationals that were invited into the United States by our government to really give a boost to agricultural production and then also work on the railroads, because how do you ship food? You got to have those railroads running. And so, that's what the Bracero program was mainly about. During times of great crisis, Mexican nationals came in and kept the economic might, the breadbasket of America, chugging along. When American citizens were off fighting wars. And then when they came back, they still were needed because, well, you had more farms, you had larger farms, farms had developed, and now later on you had refrigeration, and so you just had production, and so Mexican nationals, and then, you know, later, or during that time, Mexican-American citizens and undocumented workers, too, and then later people on visas. After the Bracero programs, you had people on visas that were invited here, but you had a lot of diversity in the different groups of demographics of Mexican citizens and Mexican Americans that were in America working during that time period. And so really, they were a great boon and positive element to the development of America in the 20th century, and helped turn us into the most powerful nation and a mass producer and exporter of goods that we are. And so that's what we're going to talk about, but more in Idaho and Pacific Northwest context. But they were all throughout America. And in World War II, in that time period, and up till 64, over 5 million braceros, male workers, came into the United States. And, they really had a massive impact. And so we'll talk about that. But let's start in Idaho and Pacific Northwest to talk about Mexican history. Prior to the Bracero workers and prior to agriculture, Mexican Americans and Mexican citizens were involved in every aspect of the development of the United States. And so you had Mexico, which was the southwestern United States, and prior to the takeover by, Texas, which was its own country in the 1830s, right? And then it was annexed along with the great swath of the Southwest after the Mexican-American War, which was basically an invasion of Mexico by the United States, a great imperial, our imperial undertaking, where we defeated Mexico and we received the southwestern states. But prior to that, you had Mexico, was the Southwest. And so you had movement and immigration throughout the Pacific Northwest and into what is the Idaho Territory. So Mexican Americans after, 1840s, were pioneers, trailblazers, and before that they were trappers and fur traders like the mountain men that we know of that came west from the east. Well, the Mexicans were every bit as involved in that, and they moved in from the south, and they'd blaze those trails that others would use. And you also had, when mining ensued, you had Mexican American miners, you had Mexican national miners, and up in Orofino Creek when they discovered gold in the 1860, and then with the discovery of more gold, you had Florence, Idaho, was a boom town. Now it's a great ghost town, But you had the development of Lewiston, Idaho, and Mexicans were involved in that. Then you had the discovery of gold on Grimes Creek by what is now Grimes Creek by George Grimes on August 2nd, 1862, and the development of the Mexican territory the year after in March of 1863. Lincoln develops the Idaho Territory because, well, you know, creates it because he's fighting the Civil War. And some Mexicans and Mexican-Americans were involved in mining up there. They were homesteaders as well. They were famous for their mule packing skills, basically. So these mule packers, most famous in Idaho, was Jesus Urquides, you know, one of the pioneers of Boise and a founder of Boise. Well, he was in Idaho or the Idaho Territory in 1863 and before, and he would pack goods in. He was in charge of strings of mules that were tied, sometimes 100 or more, that would bring in essential goods before stagecoach roads, and they would go up into these passes in these remote mining towns like Atlanta, Idaho, on the Boise River. You know, you would have Rocky Bar in the east, you know, of Boise at least. You had Idaho City, you had Placerville, Quartzsburg, you know, the Vills and the Bergs. You had Silver City in the Owyhee area. And you had mule packers that would bring in essential items there so that, you know, people wouldn't starve in the winter because you could get scurvy as a miner. You know, it wasn't just sailors and pirates. But copper wiring and machinery for the stamp mills that would break up the ore to get to the precious metals, you know, you name it, and they would pack it in. So they were essential. You also had vaqueros, and they were Mexican-American cowboys. And in the 1870s, especially in the 1880s, ranchers depended on them and would often hire them over white cowboys because the vaqueros were just better. They had the skills to, you know, make a cow not gore you, right? Or get that bull back to the herd when it was half wild from being out on the range so long. And they were essential. You had railroad workers in the 20th century. You had Mexican Americans and Mexican nationals became so over 60% of the workforce in the 20s on the railroad. Railroads in around Pocatello throughout Idaho, and you know the basically the roundhouses in Pocatello, and so Mexican Americans were involved in every aspect of the development of the United States, and so they're very they're understood to be agricultural workers mainly, and they were, and they filled a fundamental role, but they also established businesses after they settled and put down roots. Because, you know, what is the American saga and story, but it is overcoming and enduring through discrimination and hardship to create a community for you and yours and become part of that, what I like to call the chop salad. People say America's a melting pot, but that means like you know, melt into some normal kind of like bubbling mass of sameness. I like chop salad. Or salsa, right, in this context, because you have all sorts of disparate elements. Like you have the pepper, you have the tomatoes, you have the onions, you have the cilantro, you know, you have all the essentials, you have the vinegar, perhaps, depending on the sauce. And so it all is important, and it all leads to a great product. And so, you know, Mexicans are a diverse community of Mexican Americans, Mexican nationals. Undocumented workers are important too. And so, really, we're going to talk about this Bracero program and how impactful it was to American history and Mexican history. And so, in the Idaho context, let's start with, well, the early days, right? The first agricultural kind of push that used Mexican national and Mexican American labor. And so as America started to develop, right, the frontier, the Wild West, the Old West, started to be homesteaded and developed and turned into farms. You know, you had massive irrigation projects. First, you know, small-term farmers, homesteaders would dig their own ditches, but then you had private ventures of Eastern capital would develop more and bigger projects, and then you eventually had the might of the federal government. So all this wild land, right, the quote-unquote uncivilized West, that had been literally conquered and taken from Native peoples was turned into farms and ranches. And so you had the development of railroads, right? And in Idaho and the Pacific Northwest, you had rail hub centers like Pocatello, Idaho. You had the Union Pacific, an offshoot of that was the Oregon Short Line Railroad. And so you had webs of railroads going across America based off of these main lines, you know, like the Central Pacific, the Union Pacific. And so Pocatello, Idaho was a main hub where Mexican labor and Mexican Americans would work. You also had the development of farms, of course. And so you had early on in the Snake River Desert Plateau, you know, when that started to be irrigated and turned into farming land, you had sugar beets and potatoes mainly. Those were the big products. And so you had other crops too, but you know, these all had to get to market. And so in the sugar beet field, you had a company called the Utah-Idaho Sugar Company, and it built a rendering plant in eastern Idaho in 1904. And it recruited Mexican workers. And this was an economic boom for the Southwest, West and Northwest regions of the United States. And so many Mexicans took advantage of this time to basically escape what was from 1910 until 1920, a disastrous civil war of epic proportions. And then later when World War I is being fought, right? And so the first Bracero program is in this context. You had established communities of agricultural workers, or at least programs and streams of workers that could be put to use in the war effort as far as on the home front, keeping the agricultural economy going, feeding Americans, feeding the troops, you know, the railroads on track and moving those crops and goods so we could export and import goods and et cetera and et cetera. And so this was the time period in 1917 to about 1921 of the first Bracero program. And this was a program that was developed by the federal government. And they, as we said earlier, invited in Mexican nationals to work. And so what you had was an atmosphere of discrimination and intolerance and violence. Not in Idaho, but down on the border of Texas and Mexico, you had lynchings of Bracero workers. And again, they were invited in, and we needed them, and yet they were treated very poorly, lived in horrendous working conditions. And it was really a dark stain on American history, but just one that, again, is abridged. We're not taught about this, and so or the program at all. So we don't really have a grounded understanding of the roots of so many Mexican Americans and how they came to this country, and that they were extremely important and invited. So the atmosphere was such a extreme and negative just situation that what happened was that Mexico ended the program. But the program basically worked like this. You had recruitment centers in Mexico, and the first Bracero program basically compelled U.S. employers to hire them from these centers. And there was an agreement that stipulated the wages that they would be paid, the lengths of their contracts, the tasks that they were going to perform, and what conditions they would be accommodated under, you know, the quality and the type and et cetera. And so growers and the railroad companies basically were obligated to inform investigation immigration officials of low standards and of contracts that were broken by these laborers. And if they were broken, it was usually for some sort of condition or wage complaint, right? But complaints of worker abuse in 1917 were investigated by a labor commissioner, William J.A. McVetty, and he found that over 2,000 Mexicans and 500 women and children were working in southern Idaho beet fields. And in the Idaho Falls area, Shelley and the Blackfoot regions, complaints were numerous regarding their accounts or the wages that they were being paid, other living quarters, and about the clothing that they were provided for winter. And so the commissioner J.A. McVetti, he found that, and this is, quote, too much is left to the supervision of the sugar company. And he warned that the governor that these labor abuses would have put an end to the program in Idaho. And it was true. It did. There's violations of the agreements, not paying the wages. You know, the growers tried to finagle and abuse these workers, not living up to the agreement, which was already a good deal for these guys, you know? So it's kind of like, man, it's kind of scandalous. If you can take advantage of them, you do it, huh? Well, you know, so they ended the program in that stream of cheap and skilled labor. You know, as far as harvesting crops, they left. And so on December 31st, 1919, the program was abandoned in Idaho because of such abuses. But that didn't end Mexican nationals immigrating to the United States, whether for temporary or permanent stays. But basically, there was still a desperate situation going on in Mexico, right? And there was still war. And so people were coming here for better wages and a better life. And so that continued. People came to Idaho because there was still work, even though there wasn't a program, and people knew that the work was there. Now they didn't have any type of protection, not that it worked before. And so what you get is more company abuse. Growers abuse these workers because they're desperate, and they know that they're going to be abused in many cases, but they're desperate, and they need to live. And so you get the exploitation of them, though not all growers or railroad supervisors did this. Many did. And so, you know, you had, you know, corrupt contracts that were drawn up that were never intended to be lived up to. You had dirty work, dangerous work, you know, with the sugar beets using, you know, machetes and sharp implements, backbreaking labor, hunched over. You know, they didn't have access to doctors or competent doctors. You know, they had horrible living conditions where they oftentimes weren't given, you know, clean water. And so you had all sorts of stomach ailments and diseases. And the railroads continued to hire Mexican labor as well into the 1920s. And they made up, like we said earlier, 60% of the, you know, section crews that were employed in Idaho by 1930. You know, and the railroad jobs were coveted because they were something that was steady, and this could lead to placing down roots in a community and creating an enclave in a community of Mexican Americans, often at times next to different minority groups, like in Pocatello, African Americans also worked on the railroad. And then you had Eastern European and South European immigrants, and they could later basically get up that racial ladder and get out of desperation and desperate circumstances, whereas it was harder for Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, African Americans, and Mexican Americans, but yet they endured. For farm laborers, it was much different. They had, you know, it was backbreaking labor on the railroads, but farm laborers also had backbreaking labor, but they also had really nowhere stationary or solid to live. They would travel around with the crops, the rotation of the crops, and they would pick and plant and pick and plant. And while they were doing that, if they were lucky, they had a tent, but they'd live in the side of farms and fields. Sometimes the farmers, the growers would have a little space set aside for them, but usually they constructed their own dwellings out of what they would find on the road. Sometimes it was sticks and anything else they could cover for a roof, and you had logs and branches, and so that wasn't ideal living conditions. Oftentimes there were injuries. People didn't have enough food to eat, or it was a substandard food. People, if they had children, couldn't send their kids to school. And so how are you going to, you know, improve yourself and move up into more, you know, sturdy professions? It's very hard to move out of the migrant circle, as I've read. And if you were a Mexican American, you didn't have the protection of the Mexican council down in Idaho, or sorry, excuse me, in Salt Lake City, that covered Idaho. And so you didn't have these counselor officials that could intervene on wage complaints, right? and about the living conditions. And it was a very, it was rife for abuse, this atmosphere. Sometimes your abuses were at the hands of law enforcement who are at, you know, basically on the side of growers and people that were in their town or in their area. And so they usually sided with those in power. And one example was in Burley, Idaho, on July 4th, 1920. You know, it's a celebration. But you had two Mexican farm workers in a tent playing cards with two other men. And the police burst in, and when they ran because they were frightened, they were shot and killed. One of the workers was killed. And an inquest found basically that they had been shot in the back as they fled. But the jury exonerated these police officers, who they said acted in self-defense of their official duty. You know, so these kind of things happened a lot, and nobody was held accountable. These farmers would set up company towns, essentially, where you could only, you know, you could only spend your money in the company store. You know, sometimes they paid in script. You know, they weren't given, the wages they were given would come with chunks taken out of them for whatever measly accommodations were given them. And so this is a situation that was established in Idaho during the 1920s, just kind of rampant exploitation. And Idaho was one of the worst states for this, bar Texas. As the Depression approached in 1929, you had more of the green pea production occurring in Idaho. The growers in these massive companies found green peas were ideally grown in Idaho and could be packed on ice in freight cars and sent to Chicago and other eastern markets, and that they held up rather well. And so there was a huge push and want for green peas in America. And so these were really grown in mass in Idaho. And so Mexican-American workers and Mexican nationals were even more sought after to pick these green peas. And so that's the atmosphere that you have headed towards the Great Depression. And so come the Great Depression, you had these government policies and programs meant towards the production of, well, yes, sugar beets and potatoes, onions, beans, and etc., but green peas, you know. I don't know what it was about these peas, but people just wanted these damn peas, full of nutrition, and I guess, etc. But that's what was grown. And so what you had was the Farm Security Administration, the FSA, started during the New Deal. And so what started as the farm, or later would become the Farm Security Administration, was created by executive order in April of 1935. And this was the Resettlement Administration. It was one of the many New Deal programs that were created to combat the Great Depression. And it was a standalone agency that was outside any other federal department. And it was meant to assist poor farmers impacted by the Depression. One of their duties was to give low interest loans to farmers so that they could purchase better lands and restore lands that were not productive. Perhaps the better land didn't exist. They had to restore the soil. They would move urban workers to rural communities to help establish these farms and fill in for displaced rural farmers. And so they did quite a few things in the agricultural field. One of the other services of the Resettlement Administration was the building of camps for these laborers who would go out and work the fields in rural areas. They would create basically housing developments and camps that were like a satellite site, and then workers would go out from there to work the various farms, and some would go over to another location to set up a camp, but the hub site was the main housing development. There was one in Twin Falls, and there was also one built in 1939 under the auspices of the Farm Security Administration, which we'll get into, but that was called Farmway Village eventually, which was built in 1939. And so many of these programs that were offered by the Resettlement Administration were considered or criticized by conservatives as socialist experiments, quote, end quote. But to counter this kind of opposition, the director of the resettlement administration, a man by the name of Rexford Tugwell, created the Information Division. And this was in July of 1935 because he wanted to publicize that there was a need for this agency and that they were having successes. And so he created a historical section to, you know, archive and document with photos, documents, numbers, statistics, etc. And also he created a research division. They just gathered all sorts of information that's still available out there today. The Library of Congress, National Archives, et cetera, et cetera. But facing these kind of attacks from conservatives who supposed it was all leftist ideology, Tugwell actually ended up resigning. But it was at this period that they changed the name, and it was absorbed into what was the U.S. Department of Agriculture in November of 1936 is when Tugwell resigned. And so then that following year, it became known as the Farm Security Administration. And it kind of continued on with the same programs of the Resettlement Administration. The Farm Security Administration also started some new things. There were initiatives such as, working with farmers and their debtors to prevent farm and home foreclosures, introducing medical care programs to rural areas, and providing education on nutrition and hygiene to laborers, preventative measures. And so these programs were successful. One study suggested that from 1937 to 1941, the FSA-sponsored activities saw incomes increase in these rural areas by 69%, which, if even in the ballpark of true, is phenomenal growth. And so from 1890 to 1940, right, you had a whole 4 decades plus of migrant labor from Mexico being in the United States. And then those people, some of them become citizens, some of them already were. But you have now citizens, you have nationals, Mexican nationals, American citizens and migrant labor workers. You have Mexicans that are Mexican-Americans that are living within stationary communities. And then you also have undocumented workers who stay after such programs. And so you have a long history of Mexicans dating all the way back to the founding of the state, the territory, and even before. But then you have the separation of this different inflow of population that come for the agricultural labor and those jobs. But you also had companies and growers that are familiar with Mexican culture, the language to some degree, and also how to exploit them and get away with things. And so you see this in the new Bracero program, although there are designs, the system is designed to oversee that and make sure that there aren't abuses, but they do persist, and it does become a problem in Idaho again. But World War II creates this demand for agriculture. Farmers, farmers' sons, agricultural workers, your labor force are all sent to, fight World War II after December 7th, 1941. And so at the outbreak of the Second World War, it became evident what was needed, and you needed a lot of food. You need a lot of vegetables, potatoes, etc. You needed to... And so you had a group of... a government group called the U.S. War Manpower Commission that got together, and they called for, investigated the numbers they thought they'd need and sheer poundage of food produced, I guess. But you had record-shattering, quote-unquote, farm production expectations, and it was exerted tremendous pressure, this commission, on an already labor-starved Western agricultural economy. And so, officially, there was a law that was passed by Congress. And it was called in August of 1942, and it was called Public Law 45. And this was a binding agreement between Mexico and the United States, for the importation of agricultural workers. And so between 1942 and 1947, PL 45 or Public Law 45 would see or bring in 220,640 laborers, and they would enter the country. And of these, 21% were contracted by Northwestern farmers. And basically, the braceros' experiences in the Pacific Northwest were kind of shaped by their background, how they were treated, and the opinions and feelings of the growers themselves, and the communities they were a part of in the Northwest, and also the federal government and how they would respond to what their expectations were, and if they were not met, how they would respond. You know, they stipulated that workers were supposed to live in tent camps that were, you know, basic at best, but they were supposed to be clean and at least comfortable enough for them to live. But that didn't always happen. And so most men of the Bracero program, Mexican nationals, endured a lot of racial discrimination from both the employers that they worked under and the communities that they lived amongst. And so, you know, they suffered many accidents in many cases. And it was not only because of neglect or incompetence, but it was also because the workers were unfamiliar with the machinery they were working with, and, you know, owners weren't really trying to train them up, but also because a lot of the farmers had, you know, no concern for their safety, really. They were expendable, but they received low rate wages, the braceros, and if they did organize strikes, which they did, to increase their pay, they encountered basically reprisals that happened immediately almost, and sometimes they were violent. In essence, they were violent from both local officials and the farmers, owners themselves. And they basically differ little from the braceros in the Southwest and the South, and then what was experienced in the Northwest. And most of these men were young, between 20 and 30. They hadn't experienced any, if much, travel at all. And they arrived ill-prepared, basically, to deal with the hostility that they faced and unfamiliar circumstances and life, culture. And it was a tense environment because it was a war effort. A lot of crazy shit was going on around the world, and people were wary of others. Violent times make people violent. And so many of these men became upset, and they pretended they were sick or that loved ones had died and they were asked to come home. And that thus they could get out of their seasonal contracts. And in Preston, Idaho, in fact, just in 1 week, 12 men left before their contract of 6 months had been done or was concluded. And the labor officials basically would express concern that this was happening, and so they would investigate why and why they're returning early. And basically, if there was, they said that in this report that if there is a way to hasten their departure, they will find it, either by refusing to work or a violation of the wage ceiling. And that's what they said in 1945. So the war had been going on for quite some time, obviously. Many of these guys wanted to leave because, you know, the places they lived were shitty, right? And it was better to return to Mexico. And so, you know, in the Northwest, braceros would live in camps, mobile camps that would move around, made, you know, they would sleep in tents, and they would basically pack up and go quickly when they needed to go to other agricultural areas. And so it was mobile, right? And there were rules that said six workers would live together in a 16-foot by 16-foot tent, and they would have a cot. They'd have one blanket per person, and there was a stove heater that would go along with them when they could have it. So individual braceros were allowed to come with 77 pounds of personal items from Mexico, but really they didn't bring that much, much more than a change of clothes, really. workers would scavenge for things that were thrown about, crates, boxes, and they would turn this into furniture. They would make them into storage, or, you know, benches or stools, etc. And they would basically kind of build their furniture and their environment that wasn't provided for them. And then they would carve things themselves to decorate their, you know, their living quarters, essentially. In the summer, though, it was really hot. And so they couldn't live in the tent. It soaked up the heat. And during the winter, though, it was really cold. And if you didn't have a stove and you only had one blanket and you lived in a tent, well, this wasn't much protection from the weather. And if it was rainy like in the fall, well, you know, it became muddy and very uncomfortable. Nobody would want to live in that situation, especially when you're working your ass off with unappreciative people. It's hard to be treated like shit and then go back to a shitty place to live, right? And food was a problem too. So, you know, that was always, you know, if you're hungry or the food sucks, you know, it's not going to add to a good mood or lead to a good overall morale. So what the braceros complained about most was the food. It really was the same shit all the time. And they couldn't really make anything great in the, you know, kitchens because, well, it was a tent camp that went all over the place. And so it was makeshift at best. But, you know, that was the number one complaint that Northwestern federal officials got. But this was the responsibility, the food of the growers. And they had committees that were responsible for deciding what the braceros would eat at the labor centers. In 1944, officials ordered the camp manager at a place in Wendell, Idaho, to suspend all the food services because there was no refrigeration and there was no vehicle or truck to bring fresh provisions from the town. The kitchens basically posed problems because they were intense, and so fire was a problem, right? And it was huge. The feeding tents, the mess tents, I guess, were 150 feet long. That's pretty big. And they would blow over in the wind, or they would fill with dust, and that would cover the food. And so a lot of guys grumbled about this because, yeah, it's hard to eat dusty food. And also, the food, like I said, was all the same most of the time. And so, you know, you had breakfast early on in the morning, 4 a.m. to 5 essentially, really early, somewhere in there. And, you know, you would basically get an egg. You know, you wouldn't get that much to eat. And then later at lunch, you know, 6-7 hours later, they would eat their lunch, and it was usually sandwiches. You know, you had about 3 sandwiches, one with meat, one with egg, and that was spread out over, and another was just jelly. You had, you know, usually a sweet roll, and some milk was also there. And anyway, there was no refrigeration, so you didn't get much fresh stuff. And the sandwiches were prepared or made way in advance, and so they were not tasty sandwiches at all. And the milk they were given was, you know, chunky or sour, and it was disgusting to eat or drink. And so, yeah, a lot of them had sack lunches, crappy sack lunches. You know, they didn't have any alternative, like in the lunchroom at high school where you could get some chicken nuggets or something. But, you know, the bread was usually white bread, and it was, you know, crappy lunch meat. And that was it. You know, not much to look forward to, essentially, for lunch when you're super hungry. And so another problem was a lack of iron, right? So you had a lot of anemia in these camps. And the other thing was that you had gastrointestinal issues, right? You had food poisoning was rampant because people wouldn't wash the dishes correctly, and They didn't have real good cups that they could take out to the farm sites, and so they'd just pick up whatever they could. And, you know, there was a place in Oregon, Grants Pass, where you had 500 braceros that fell sick, and 300 required hospitalization. And though some managers of these camps attempted to rectify the situation, improve food, and improve sanitation, abuses were rampant, unfortunately. The other thing was there wasn't much to occupy the time of the workers on an off day or time. They didn't have much recreation. Sometimes they brought in movies, or church services, Catholic services, for the most part. There were dances, but it wasn't much fun because there weren't many women. There were issues. But one of the biggest issues, of course, that we've talked about is discrimination. And Idaho in the Pacific Northwest received the most notorious reputations for this discrimination. And so Idaho was really one of the worst places in the country for ill treatment of braceros. And, one of the worst places was Canyon County, Caldwell, and Nampa. So much so that, Mexico, the Mexican government in 1946 threatened to leave the state and not have any workers go back. And in 2 years later, they canceled the program. In Nampa and Caldwell, Canyon County, where racism was at its worst, a Mexican official government investigation found signs that basically forbid Mexicans to enter. Some of them said, "No dogs, no Mexicans." There were beer parlors in Caldwell, 7 of them, and 11 in Nampa that had signs that said, "No Mexicans." But it wasn't everybody. So there was a notice, NOTUS, Notice Idaho Farm Labor Committee. And they had problems with it. They had contracted with braceros, and they said they criticized Caldwell businesses and the Chamber of Commerce for violating orders against discrimination in Public Law 45 that started this whole thing. And they said that it jeopardized the growers and their businesses and their farms. And so they said, if they weren't going to let Mexican braceros in to shop during daylight hours, at least have them open at night so that they could shop without other people present that were going to give them shit. So that's another thing. Working all day, eating shitty food, not having anywhere great to sleep, and then having people give you shit in the towns, in the places that you're working for and trying to better. It had to get to you. I'd want to go home too, or at least I'd want to punch a person or two. But that was what braceros faced by and large in Idaho, unfortunately, though not at all places. And that's a harsh reality of the situation for all braceros. But in Idaho in particular, and Texas, you didn't have a lot to be proud of as far as conduct towards these braceros. The committee in Notice Idaho basically said, and here's a quote, of the braceros, they're doing us a service. If by our discriminating signs we are to lose the labor, it will be a blow to the farmers in this area. But, few really cared. And so Mexico pulled out of Idaho and said it's off limits and they wouldn't go back. So that's really a F+, if you ask me, on staying on Idaho's past. And so Idaho was cut off from importing any Mexican national labor in October of 1948. And the counselor in Portland, Oregon said, and here's a quote, that farmers in Idaho are hereby suspended from importation of nationals of my country for any purpose until further notice. This suspension is prompted by discrimination against our nationals on social and economic grounds and by violations of the international agreement and the individual workers' contracts. And so it wasn't just a broad issue. It was also on an individual level where they're being screwed over as to how they're, what they're being fed, what they're eating, living, and what they're being paid. A lot of times growers would pay them less than they were expected to earn, and that was in their contract. And it was like, well, tough shit, you got to pay for this, this, and this, which, you know, wasn't fair and wasn't what they had signed up to, but there wasn't much that workers themselves could do. And so, you know, people who know they can exploit desperate people often do. And so that's what happens in Idaho and other parts of the Pacific Northwest. Another issue that Braceros had was, hospitals would refuse to treat them often, sometimes because of racism, other times because they were afraid that they wouldn't be able to pay, and perhaps they knew that they were given shitty wages and were screwed over all the time. I don't know. The one suggestion was, the federal government should set up their own infirmaries because, well, local hospitals wouldn't help them. But they were denied treatment for injuries or illnesses, which is just what you want to have happen when you are ill and desperately need treatment. So that had to have been fun. And when the Braceros did receive treatment, it was poor quality or minimal. And this could be a real danger. In 1945, in one instance, a Bracero was shot in the gut, and there was no information as to why, but he was treated, and then due to poor treatment and infection, he died 6 weeks or a month and a half later. They said that the treatment of this worker was horrible. So the Agricultural Workers Health Association did. That was another organization that was set up to deal with this kind of stuff. But this is what they said in the report about his treatment by this doctor, that they had buried him, essentially. So they said burial visually eliminated medical incompetence. And it is indeed unfortunate in such cases that the physician cannot be given as the cause of death. Yeah, they can't say the doctor did it, right? And anyway, nobody seemed to care very much in these instances. In Idaho in 1945, that same year, you had some braceros that were told to fight forest fires. And there was a tree that fell on one of the workers and it injured his leg. He had been examined in the hospital at Grangeville, Idaho, and he was found medically capable to return to work. And so he was back fighting fires, but he had considerable pain in his leg that was lasting and not going away. And so a week later, he had his leg examined again, and a doctor said there's no reason that he's suffering. This doesn't make sense. And so they were told that, you know, go back to work. But this employee, this Bracero, went to a War Food Administration office, and he explained his situation. So they sent him to a place, and he got an X-ray, and it showed that his name was Ramon, but his leg was broken. And he wrote to the Mexican consul in Salt Lake City and basically to get compensated for the work that he missed. And he also wrote the president of the United States, FDR, and he wrote to him, "They do as they please." And this is his complaint. And he said, "Because I cannot speak English." But he was fortunate that he didn't die, because this happened a lot. People get infected, and their injuries would get infected, and they would die because of negligence or a lack of anybody of importance giving a shit. And so this was a real problem also. In southern Idaho in 1946, in the winter of 1946, you had blizzard conditions that came down all over southern Idaho. And so you had a new batch of recruits that had come in from California, and they had thin clothing. They weren't used to the weather, and they refused to work. And so basically this strike was like, give us better clothing so that we don't freeze to death or get hypothermia, you know, or frostbite. And so in one instance, sugar beet growers basically threatened these guys with high fines and tried to get them nervous about being paid, or, you know, intimidation tactics to be basically get them back to work. One camp manager, though, said that it's not right what they're doing to them, for them to work under such conditions. And he said that I noticed some of these days the local help was not in the fields, right? And so in general, I believe that nationals were not treated as they, you know, should have been, he says. And if locals aren't in the fields or expected to be so, then why are these braceros? And it was because a lot of the growers didn't really care. And so they didn't want to expend the resources to get the proper clothing for these guys to work in, or give them the day off. You know, production is money. Production, production, production at all costs. And so this is also reflected in all the injuries that happened during work on these fields. Their inexperience, a lack of training, no safety equipment. And then, you know, you had dangerous and powerful machinery. There was in Weezer, there was an incident where a man severed his finger while he was working. And it was on a seed harvester, and, you know, ripped his fingers right off. There were places in Oregon where guys had fractured skulls. This guy was pinned down under a piece of machinery, and it started to lower on his head, and it was fractured his skull. And a bolt went through his skull. But he lived unbelievably. But that didn't need to happen, right? They needed proper training, and they needed better equipment and safety standards. And so this was rife throughout the Bracero program. Because of the working conditions and low pay and the crappy food and accommodations, you had strikes generally not throughout the rest of the country, but really in the Pacific Northwest. It was kind of a unique thing to the Pacific Northwest Braceros. But, you know, there were strikes, and there were strikes all the way up until 1947, when the Public Law 45 ended. There were strikes in Washington. There were strikes in Oregon, and a lot of these were due to wages, low wages. But these work stoppages or strikes, growers would end them sometimes violently. Instigators would sometimes be labeled as instigators, and like this wasn't the problem of the whole camp. Many of these strikes weren't so easy to end either on the parts of the growers. In Idaho, it had the worst wages of any place really in the Pacific Northwest. And so you had really stingy farmers, if you will. And a lot of times they just had a lot of labor disputes. You would think that they would save a penny by paying them more in the end and just not having these strikes. But in February of 1943, there was a measure introduced by the state legislature to curb labor unrest by the braceros, but it prohibited union organizations for workers, basically. There couldn't be any unionization on the ranch or farm or whatever plant that you might have for the processing of these things without the owner's consent. So obviously that's just a way of saying, well, this shit ain't gonna happen. But, you know, they said picket lines and boycotts were illegal. And so they tried to nip that in the bud. But without, you know, bar that law, In 1944, June of, the braceros in Preston went on strike because of their poor wages. And the grower said those breaking their contracts would be taken out to the road where they would be out on their own. The proper immigration authorities would be notified and they would be picked up by these authorities. They'd be placed in jail to await court action. In the meantime, while awaiting for court, they would have to work for 90 days without compensation except board and room. End quote. And farmers weren't afraid to use violence because there was such a lack of repercussions from the federal government and by local officials. You had violence. And so in Preston, 5 months later, basically after the first strike, you had another one. And farmers basically got violent with it. A camp manager in the area responded or said that last Friday, one of the farmers in the area assaulted one of the Mexicans and gave him a good mauling, and this was over a strike, but he wasn't charged. And so really the only thing the Mexican government could do about wages and discrimination and violence was shut down the area to immigration and their workers, nationals going there. And so that's what happened in Idaho that October of 1948. But in another strike occurred in July of 1945, though. Violence didn't scare the 170 Mexican workers that went on strike in Idaho Falls. And it started with only 50 braceros, and they were new to the camp, and they didn't want to pick at the orchards and cherries in this case at the rate that they were paid. And so what the farmers did, as more people really joined this 50, is that they cut off food, right? And they closed the kitchen essentially, and the men started to starve, and they were very hungry after more than a week. And so some of the men started to walk back, and they were assaulted and harassed by more ardent braceros who said, don't break the strike. And so this harassment basically allowed for the sheriff in Bonneville County and also the Idaho State Highway Patrol. This gave them the cause to enter the camp and order a riot that they said was going to happen. And then they offered to protect the braceros who wanted to go back to work. But nobody left the camp for 9 days. And then finally, a lack of food and starting to starve ended it, the strike. One of the most successful strikes was 600 braceros from four different camps around Nampa, Idaho, in June of 1946. But the crops at that time was really important to the growers because it was time to harvest. And so the growers in the area had a lack of prisoners of war, had helped pick them, like Germans and Italians that were kept in the area had been picking the crops in that area until they were sent home in 1946 and it was ended. And so they didn't have that stream of labor available. And so they really needed the braceros, but they weren't paying them very well. So the braceros went on strike in Canyon County. Labor officials for the government talked about the strike as a general strike, because it included so many camps, and they were demonstrating in the streets of Nampa, and they just defied the growers and the government openly. Supervisors that spoke Spanish would go out and negotiate with the workers and try to call off the strike, and that there would be a hearing about the problems that the strikers had that would be arranged by the Mexican consul. But after 12 days, workers and growers were able to meet and testify at this board that was assembled for the decision on wage issues. And so the braceros said that they wanted a uniform wage or a general wage of 70 cents an hour. And these growers said workers that earned 75 cents an hour were skilled laborers and they were American workers. And that's how they responded. Now, in response, the Mexican consul tried to, you know, force an increase, and they threatened growers with, and quote, considering that ample opportunity has been given farmers' associations of the Nampa district to revise discriminatory attitudes towards contracted Mexican nationals, please proceed to remove workers at your earliest convenience unless 75 cents per hour prevailing wage in nearby areas is recognized before Monday, July 22nd. They were reinforced by a man named Carl G. Isett of the Federal Production and Marketing Administration in Portland. And he argued that a solution to the workers' protest was, quote-unquote, critical for the continuation of the Bracero program. But the strike ended before really anything could be done. And so there was no increase in wages, and the growers really, though they were a little nervous by the consul's threat, the Mexican consul's threat, this is what they said of the strike in a statement, that the extremely rebellious attitude of the braceros was unfortunate and unjustified. But the growers also persuaded local police officials to break the strike by arresting strikers and giving them felony charges that weren't earned, essentially. But, you know, there were other protests that were all over the Pacific Northwest. You know, in Washington and Walla Walla, there was a strike over 12 days. Labor strife would continue in the Pacific Northwest until 1947-48. When the program was ended in 48. And so this labor unrest was really, you know, cemented in the Pacific Northwest. And some of these guys came from, you know, really impoverished situations with terrible living conditions. But, you know, that just makes what they experienced in the Pacific Northwest and Idaho that much more evident as far as how horrible it was. The tent camps weren't comfortable. And then on top of this, they're working hard, really hard, back-breaking labor. They're getting fed poorly. They're getting treated poorly by the community, sometimes violently. They're being called dogs, you know, by local businesses and eateries and saloons and et cetera. And so, you know, they don't have really women around, and they're just, it's a desperate situation, and then they're getting paid horribly. And so, you know, the program ends in Idaho in 48, and then overall, PL 45 ends in April of 1947. And so you got a new law, and this was Public Law 40. And this had some major changes in it, and they had to be paid more by the employers. And then employers had to pay for the cost of transportation between Mexico and their sites in America. And, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, the usage of braceros really declined. But in the Southwest and the rest of the country, it increased with PL 40. And the program didn't end nationally until 1964. And you had upwards of 5 million braceros come in to work in that time period from 48 until 64. And so, you know, though things improved in living conditions, you know, they didn't, the problems didn't go away. And the pay issues didn't go away because, again, desperate circumstances lead to exploitation by the greedy. And though not all growers were greedy, enough of them were to really cause a problem. And so Idaho does not have a good track record for how it treated the braceros. It wasn't just Idaho, but like I said, Idaho was one of the worst, and it's evidence that they closed down the program, the Mexican government themselves, and only to be outdone by Texas, where lynchings actually happened, at least during the first Bracero program. So there is a lot of shame to go around for the treatment of Braceros by the citizens of these states. But not all citizens did, of course, do this, but enough did. And so the war created this need because there was such a boom in agricultural production and the economy that, there were severe labor shortages because of this. They needed so many guys. And then, other pools of labor, well, they were gone fighting. And when they returned, there was already cheaper labor on hand. And so Mexican workers were brought in to fill this gap. They came supposedly protected by contracts that would enforce their civil rights. But right away, when they wound up in the Northwest on farms and production centers and et cetera, employers, growers threw out these agreements, basically. And when Braceros wanted to increase their wages and better their treatment, at work and then bike the communities that discriminated against them, the federal government was a no-show, basically. There were reports and there was information, but yeah, there was no intervention. And so with the lack of authority or repercussions, they were exploited more. And the desperate can be exploited easier, and so greedy men did this to them. And in Idaho, there were greedy men, which was the worst of the Pacific Northwest states for this, though it happened everywhere. The program continued on until 1964, and I guess in some ways it was a major success because the production was major. And so, like we said earlier in the podcast, there was a agricultural boom. The war ends and there's new technology. Refrigeration means they can send these crops far afield. And so more production, more money, and in some ways more exploitation. And so after the 1964, the end of the Bracero program, you had H-2A visas that were issued for agricultural workers to come in from Mexico. And you also had H-2B, which were non-agricultural workers to come in. And so you had a lot of labor brought in because it benefited employers, it benefited businesses. And so I wish I could say that discrimination of these groups ended, but it didn't. You also get undocumented workers that are coming in and working the fields for much less than they should be. Minimum wage, of course, is applied, but there's a wish on the part of employers to pay them much less, the undocumented workers. So that's why they can't come, because, well, they're desperate people in many regards. They want to get away from bad conditions in Mexico, but not just Mexico. You got Central America, South America. And so yeah, they want a chunk of the American dream. They want a better situation in life for their kids. And so we have this argument that they're breaking the law, right, and should be punished. Whereas I, have heard the opposite, which is we need pathways to citizenship, basically, because if you're going to try and get across the rivers and of Central America and Mexico, and then try and get across the Rio Grande and through Texas and et cetera, et cetera, and make your way throughout the United States, then you must really want to become a citizen. So that's the litmus test I need, I guess. But, they also are brought in by employers who pay them little or less. So who do we want to blame in the United States, right? We want to blame these workers that can be more easily scapegoated, right? And that's what we do, because it's easier to do that than to blame the people that are hiring them, right? Because those are the owners, those are the powerful and the rich. And essentially, it's hard to blame them and get any type of change. So we blame those that can be easily scapegoated. You also have migrant communities that aren't undocumented, but we lump in with, undocumented people, or these nationals that come over on visas. There's a lot of generalization based on racism and a lack of understanding, which is where most scapegoating and hatred comes from. By and large, these people from Mexico, whether they be nationals or undocumented, the math shows that they've been helpful by and large to the development of the economy in the United States. And right now, I wish that Idaho had a better track record at this point, but they continually have to fight for basic rights. So, for instance, the use of or placement of outhouses on the farms. Nobody wants to be working and then have to go pop a squat for a number one or a two out in a farm field, and nobody wants to come across that when they're picking fruit or vegetables and doing backbreaking labor close to the ground. Nobody wants to come across, a turd, or a puddle of pee. That's no fun, and it causes disease, So it's a continual fight for more acceptance. But you do get communities, migrant workers that, are able to better their situation and do. Again, I turn back to this American dream, whether you're undocumented or you're a national and maybe you stay after your visa's expired, or you're a Mexican-American that's on the migrant circle, but you want to become stationary, you want to save up to start a business, send your kids to school, learn English if you don't already know it. It's all part of wanting to live the American dream, and what's more American than struggling and overcoming odds and discrimination. So whether you're talking about Chinese American communities, Japanese American, Irish American, African American, and Mexican American, and on and on. Really, the similarity to one degree or the other, and usually the lighter skin you are, the less discrimination you have to face, but it's still tough. The Irish were able to move up that racial ladder, whereas other groups aren't able to as easily or at all. And so, but it is a struggle that is part of the world, but also coming to America for a better life, right? From day one, that is what was needed, right? That's what started America, is this need to start a better life. And so that's what Mexican Americans did from, the 1860s in Idaho's case, and even before, all the way up to present day. It is the struggle to find security and comfort in your life. And my hat's off to Mexican Americans that endured. I love the culture. I love the food. I like the vibrant music and colors of the clothing that they bring to their culture. And I think we're better for their presence in America and in Idaho. And that's all I have to say about that. And thanks for tuning in. This is all I could do really on this is a summary, because it's a huge topic. You really could dive into more, but that's for other people. And I used many sources from different professors, for example, from the University of Washington, writing about the Bracero program. I used general history essays about Latino communities in Idaho and the Pacific Northwest. I had a great book called Idaho's Place, which is an anthology of basically different groups that you don't always consider in Idaho. It's called A New History of the Gem State is its subheading. I used other, primary sources as far as the remembrances of Bracero workers themselves and migrant workers. And so you always have to have those great secondary sources by legit historians or scholars, and you have to have that great primary source material from the day and age and the people that you're studying. So thanks for tuning in. I'll check in next week for a new episode, I hope. Thanks for listening. This is Mark Iverson of the American History Unabridged Podcast signing off.